to a podcast for the Queensland Integrity and Health Series. My name is Tracy Pickett and I am a medico-legal advisor with Avant and a director of the Queensland Doctors Health Program, now known as Doctors Health in Queensland. Each year, the Office of the Integrity Commissioner, together with its supporting partners, Health Ethics and Law Queensland, among others, arranges an Integrity in Health Series. This year's topic is mandatory reporting for health professionals. What are the ethical and legal ramifications? As a result of the global pandemic, which is presently underway, we are convening this series as a podcast, and today I'm delighted to be sharing our integrity and health journey with our partners, the Office of the Health Ombudsman, Doctors Health in Queensland, Avant, and HEAL, HEAL being the Queensland chapter of the Australasian Association of Bioethics and Health Law. Joining me as co-host during this series are our Integrity Commissioner, Dr. Nicola Stepanov, Dr. Margaret Kay, the Medical Director working with Doctors Health in Queensland, and Dr. Melissa Naidu, Chief Medical Officer and Head of Clinical Innovation for NIB. We have a stellar lineup of interviewees, including Associate Professor Ruth Stewart, who is the new National Rural Health Commissioner, Dr. Claire Walker, the immediate past President of the Queensland Rural Doctors Association, and Outback GP with obstetric and anaesthetic specialties, Dr. John Paul Koo, psychiatrist, Dr. Alex Markwell, emergency physician at the Royal Brisbane and Women's Hospital and Greenslopes Private Hospital and chair of the Queensland Clinical Senate, and Emeritus Professor of Medical Ethics at the University of Queensland and adjunct professor with the Health Law Research Centre at QUT, Malcolm Parker. To start our discussion today, I have the honour of speaking to the Queensland Health Ombudsman, Andrew Brown. Welcome, Andrew. Thank you for speaking with us today.
Hi, Tracy, and look, thanks for having me.
It's an absolute pleasure. Andrew, before we kick off, I'd like to tell our listeners a little bit about you. Andrew was appointed to the role of the Queensland Health Ombudsman in May 2018 for a three-year term. He has more than 28 years' experience in the public sector, primarily in the areas of legal services, regulatory oversight, and complaints management. Prior to his appointment, Andrew was the Deputy Ombudsman at the Queensland Ombudsman's Office. That's a very difficult word, Andrew. And he's also worked at Queensland Corrective Services in numerous roles, including as the Chief Inspector of Prisons and Director of Legal Services. He holds a Bachelor of Arts and Bachelor of Law and a Master of Public Administration and is admitted as a solicitor. But now to get down to business, Andrew. Today's topic is mandatory reporting for health professionals. What are the ethical and legal ramifications? So can I ask you to set the scene and explain how mandatory notifications by health professionals, as opposed to other complaints, are managed in Queensland?
Yes, thanks, Tracy. In Queensland, it is a somewhat complex system, and what makes it a bit complicated is that it involves the interplay between two key agencies who work as co-regulators in this space. We have my office, the Office of the Health Ombudsman, which is a state-based body, and we also have ARPA and the National Boards, which is a national scheme. And these two bodies together manage complaints and notifications about registered practitioners in Queensland. And matters such as mandatory notifications move between those two bodies. Now, just for completeness, there's a third body involved in this space as well for notifications that are at the serious end, and that's QCAT, the Queensland Civil and Administrative Tribunal. So that makes three players. If I start by talking about the OHO and its role, it's the single point of contact for all health service complaints and notifications in Queensland. So all mandatory notifications come through the OHO's front door. We are the front door of the system, if you like. Now, once we receive a notification, another key role is for us to determine which body should deal with it. And the system really requires that we get the matter to the right place as quickly and as efficiently as we can. So when it comes to mandatory notifications, there are really three key options for the OHO when it receives the notification through the front door. Firstly, we can refer it to APRA to manage in conjunction with the relevant national board. So if it's a notification about a registered nurse, we would refer it to APRA and the Nursing and Midwifery Board. Physio, it would be APRA and the Physiotherapy Board. This is the most common pathway for complaints and notifications that we receive about registered practitioners. And most of these referrals to APRA happen in the first 7 days of the OHO receiving it. So, for example, back in 1819, of the 4,000 complaints and notifications we received about registered practitioners, about 2,500, or just over 60%, were referred to APRA to deal with. I also just want to make the point here that the OHO doesn't do a merits assessment of the matter before it sends it to APRA. It's for APRA to assess it and investigate it when it arrives to determine whether there's substance to it. There's a bit of a misunderstanding out there that because the OHO has referred a matter to APRA, that the OHO has determined that it can be substantiated, but that's not the case. It's really up for APRA to make that determination. So the second option for the OHO when it receives a notification is the OHO can retain it and investigate it ourselves. Now, like APRA, the OHO can exercise various powers when we investigate a notification, and that includes taking statements from witnesses, executing search warrants, compelling the production of documents, interviewing practitioners. And after the investigation, if we think the allegations are capable of substantiation, then we can refer the matter to QCAT and prosecute it as a disciplinary matter. Then QCAT will ultimately issue sanctions against the practitioner if QCAT finds the matter is substantiated. And I'll come back and talk about this shortly, but suffice it to say that this pathway is really reserved for the most serious of matters. Thirdly, when we receive a notification, we could also decide to take no further action in relation to it. And this will occur where the complaint or notification may be obviously frivolous or very trivial or so lacking in substance that nothing can be done with it. In that case, we can take no further action. So, Tracy, that's a brief description of the three bodies involved and the options open to the OHO when we receive a mandatory notification.
Thanks, Andrew. And it's very helpful to know that your office don't actually investigate when matters are referred to APRA, because that is, as you've said, a point of confusion for many practitioners. So we were looking at finding out what are the factors which determine whether you retain it within your office at OHO or whether APRA will handle a particular notification. You just indicated that you look at the significance of the complaint in making that determination?
Certainly. So really it's the nature and the subject matter of the notification that will ultimately determine which body deals with it and whether it will ultimately be prosecuted through QCAT. And really, mandatory notifications can be made about three things or a combination of the three. So it can be made about a health impairment, about conduct, namely sexual misconduct or intoxication, or performance where there's a significant departure from professional standards, or there can be a combination of any of those three. So what the notification is about and how serious it is will determine how and by whom the notification will be dealt with. So I guess if we start with a notification about health impairment, because that's the clearest and easiest pathway, a notification about a practitioner's health, including a mandatory notification, always goes to APRA and the relevant board to manage. Under the Health Ombudsman Act, the health, the OHO must refer it. And in these cases, ARPA is likely to do a health assessment. If the health impairment can be substantiated, then either the relevant board or a panel of the board can determine and finalise the matter. And they have various options and powers to deal with these matters, which could include imposing conditions like drug testing or treatment, or at its highest, and in rare cases, temporarily suspend registration. So short of referring it to ARPA, the OHO has nothing really to do with an impairment notification. If I turn to notifications about conduct and performance, they're a little bit more complicated. And where they go, whether it's to ARPA or OHO, will depend on how serious the conduct and performance issues are. And generally speaking, when it's up the very serious end of the spectrum, for example, a criminal offence, say committed by a practitioner against a patient, then it will be retained and investigated and prosecuted through QCAT by the OHO. And what we're dealing with here is what's called professional misconduct, conduct that falls substantially below what is expected of a practitioner, or where the conduct suggests that they're not a fit and proper person to hold registration. Now, in March this year, there were some amendments to the Health Ombudsman Act that changed the test for what matters the OHO must retain. And the new test essentially provides that the OHO must retain a matter that amounts to professional misconduct and the matter poses a significant issue for the health and safety of the public. So it used to be that the OHO used to have to retain all professional misconduct matters. Now, I, as the Health Ombudsman, have a discretion to refer these matters to ARPA, provided the matter doesn't involve a significant issue for health and safety. So in practice, now the OHO retains the most serious of matters. It's really the tip of the pyramid when it comes to serious conduct and performance. And what the OHO looks at nowadays in deciding whether or not to retain a matter or to refer it to ARPA is also the likely sanction that might follow should the allegations be substantiated. If that's likely to be suspension of registration or cancellation, then the matter is more likely to be retained by the OHO. And I can talk about some examples shortly. What flows from that is that less serious professional misconduct matters and conduct and performance that doesn't meet the professional misconduct threshold is generally referred by the OHO to ARPA and the board to manage. And these are likely to be cases where the ultimate sanction is not suspension or cancellation of registration, although there may still be some cases where this is the ultimate result. And when these matters are referred to ARPA, they will assess them. They may also investigate them on behalf of the board. If the allegations can be substantiated, then in most cases, the matter will be finalised by a board or a panel. And a board has powers to do things like caution practitioners or impose conditions like training or supervision. And a panel has more powers. It may formally reprimand or even temporarily suspend registration. So most of those matters will be determined and finalised by a board or a panel, but a board can still decide to prosecute a matter through QCAT. And they will likely still do that in relation to the more serious matters they receive. So just to repeat, sort of health goes to ARPA and the board. Very serious conduct matters go to OHO for prosecution through QCAT, and less serious conduct and performance matters go to ARPA, with most of those being dealt with by board or a panel. Now, that just leaves mandatory notifications about health and conduct and performance. So these are the combined matters where often there's a causal link between the health impairment and the conduct. So drug theft, for example, to feed an addiction would be an example. So in these cases, these combined cases, the health impairment, as I've mentioned earlier, must go to ARPA. And provided the conduct doesn't pose a serious issue for health and safety of the public, that test I talked about earlier, then the conduct and performance can also go to ARPA and the board to manage. So prior to that amendment in March this year, we had to split health and professional misconduct matters, and the health would go to ARPA and the conduct would be retained to OHO. But now most of these conduct matters associated with health can be referred to ARPRA. And it's only in those very serious professional misconduct matters involving significant health and safety issues will they be retained by the OHO. So Tracy, that's a fair amount of information. I hope it makes sense.
Absolutely. And Andrew, I'm glad you referred to those changes because they did provide some clarity in terms of not only where matters will be dealt with, but also the national law changes in terms of what is a significant risk to the public. I just wanted to clarify, the mandatory notifications we're talking about are very high threshold issues. They are the most significant complaints. So are you able to give us some of the examples that you were talking about of the matters that would be handled by your office?
Yes, certainly. They do have a high threshold, and although I don't have the data in front of me, so off the top of my head, you know, I spoke about 4,000 in total complaints and notifications about registered practitioners in 18-19. There was only a couple of hundred of those 4,000 that were actually mandatory notifications. So it is a very small proportion. But just to give some examples to put a little bit of context around this, if we start with health, an example might be that a mandatory notification is made by a hospital about a practitioner, say a registered nurse or a doctor, who's been admitted to that hospital's emergency department with a drug overdose. The mandatory notification would have been made if it was thought that the practitioner, you know, their serious drug addiction may be likely to detrimentally affect their capacity to practice, which is the definition of a health impairment.
Okay. I found this on the web for a serious drug addiction.
Sorry, that was Siri going off then. That mandatory notification is made to the OHO, but the OHO will immediately refer it to ARPRA and the board to manage. And there'd be likely to be a health assessment. The board may impose conditions to manage the stage return of the practitioner to the workplace with some drug testing or treatment conditions. And if all goes well, the practitioner is ultimately reintegrated back into practice. Now, to make that example a little bit more complicated, say the practitioner who has a substance addiction also stole some script pads from the workplace and forged some scripts for, say, S4 or S8 medication. What we now have is an impairment, the drug addiction, plus professional misconduct, the theft and forgery, which may have also resulted in some criminal charges. Now, where there's no evidence that the drugs were diverted from the patient, from patients, or the practitioner was consuming in the workplace, the OHO is likely to say, well, this is likely to be professional misconduct, but it doesn't meet the test for it being a serious issue for health and safety of the public. So both the health impairment and the conduct would be referred to ARPRA to manage both. If we were to ratchet up the seriousness of the conduct again, and the conduct of the practitioner included, say, widespread diversion of S8 medication like fentanyl from patients by, say, swapping out fentanyl for saline, and we had patients missing out on pain relief, then arguably it would be conduct that poses a serious issue for health and safety of the public. And that conduct would be likely to be retained by the OHO and investigated and finalised through QCAT. But the health impairment would still go to ARPRA and the board. And look, I guess finally, some examples of the kind of conduct that the OHO would be likely to retain would be offences committed by practitioners against patients, so sexual assaults or serious assaults, particularly where criminal charges are laid. And when charges are laid, the OHO investigation is paused until criminal proceedings are finalised. The OHO is likely to retain boundary violation matters with patients where patients' vulnerabilities have been exploited. So, for example, sexual relationship between a psychiatrist and a patient or serious financial exploitation of a patient. And finally, the OHO would be likely to retain serious criminal conduct by a practitioner in their private capacity. which would be likely to impact on their fitness to hold registration. So, for example, practitioner charged with rape or indecent treatment, or a fraud involving hundreds of thousands of dollars. So, Tracy, I hope that sort of quick sketch of how it works has gone some way to demystifying the system, because, as I said at the beginning, it is somewhat complicated.
It is a very complicated and complex issue, Andrew, and we do have limited time here this morning, but that's only the tip of the iceberg. And what you've just said just illustrates how complex the issues are and how interwoven all of the issues surrounding notification become when you're looking at the health practitioner area. So thank you so much for spending some time to explain some of the issues to us. We very much appreciate you doing so. And
no, thank you, Tracy. Thank you for the opportunity. It's been a pleasure.
Wonderful. Well, thanks so much, and thank you all for listening.